Good afternoon. The first case for argument on the en banc calendar for today and for tomorrow is the legislature of the state of Nevada et al. Versus the Honorable James A. Settlemyer and other senators and businesses and other entities. Case number 81924. Are counsel ready to proceed? Mr. Newby?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you ready to proceed? Mr. Powers?
I believe Mr. Powers will be starting on our side of the caption, Your Honor, but yes, we are collectively ready to proceed.
Okay, Ms. Peterson, you ready to go?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you.
Okay. Before we begin, I want to advise with respect to this case that pursuant to a scheduling conference that I conducted with counsel on March the 4th, and given the urgency that the parties advised the court of in this matter, a very aggressive scheduling order was entered consistent with the party's stipulation that required a number of briefs to be filed in a uniquely short amount of time. And pursuant to their request and my conclusion that the case warranted oral argument, we set this oral argument for 60 minutes for today. The court will make its best efforts to make a decision in this matter as time permits upon the submission of the case. Mr. Powers, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. For the record, Kevin Powers, General Counsel, LCB Legal Division, on behalf of the legislature and the individual defendants, Senate Majority Leader Nicole Cannizzaro, and Secretary of the Senate, Claire Cliff. The district court erred in this case by concluding that the two bills, SB 542 and SB 551, were subject to the two-thirds supermajority requirement in Article 4, Section 18, Sub 2 of the Nevada Constitution. That provision applies only to bills which create, generate, or increase any public revenue in any form. Neither of the bills did that. Their actual effect was to maintain the existing rates at their existing amount so that the existing level of revenue remained the same and would continue at that same rate. The district court found that because the technology fee in SB 542 had a future sunset or expiration, and that SB 551, because it had a future decrease, that by removing those future events, that the legislature thereby created, generated, or increased public revenue. But that is not the actual effect of each bill. The revenue stream remained flat. There was no change in that revenue stream. At the time the legislature made its determination of whether these bills were subject to the two-thirds requirement, it relied on an opinion letter from LCB Legal, which analyzed the current state of law, thoroughly and comprehensively reviewing existing case law from other jurisdictions with similar supermajority requirements. LCB Legal advised the legislature that it could reasonably conclude that these two pieces of legislation were not subject to the supermajority requirement. Generally, when the legislature acts on the advice of its counsel, that provides a reasonable interpretation of a constitutional provision, the judiciary typically gives the legislature deference in its counsel's selection of that interpretation. The two-thirds majority requirement was put in place in the mid-1990s along with other supermajority requirements in other jurisdictions, in particular Oklahoma and Oregon, who have the most case law interpreting these supermajority provisions. At the time, the Settlement Division was the sponsor of the initiative that put the two-thirds provision on the ballot. And he also testified in 1993 before the legislature when he proposed a two-third provision through the constitutional amendment process for the legislature. Although that legislation didn't pass in 1993, his testimony provides insight into the intent of the two-thirds requirement. Demoin Gibbons made clear that the two-thirds requirement wasn't intended to impair existing revenues or hamstring the operations of state government. The goal was to stop legislation that would increase public revenue or expand existing revenue through new taxes or increases in existing taxes. And the goal was to subject them to the supermajority requirement so that those new taxes had a higher threshold to meet. The intent was never to hamstring the government and impair existing revenues. In this case, we are dealing with existing revenues. The $1 DMD technology fee remains at $1 after SB 42 was passed. The 2% rate and 1.475% rate of the modified business tax, or MBT, remain the same after the passage of SB 551. Both of these bills are consistent with the intent that the voters understood that existing revenues would not be impaired. Simply, the burden on the fee payer or the taxpayer has remained the same. There has been no change from one fiscal year to the next fiscal year. And again, because this supermajority provision
is... Mr. Powers, if I can interrupt you, sir, this is Justice Herndon in Carson City. I'm curious, from a historical precedent perspective with the legislature, back in 2011, there was a bill passed, AB 561, that extended a prospective sunset date in regard to allowing taxes and fees to be paid in advance and thereby kind of maintained what had been in effect. 2013, SB 475, a bill was passed delaying the statutory rate decrease in excise taxes, so it maintained what was in place. 2015, SB 483, bill was passed maintaining a $200 business license fee rather than letting it drop down to $100, so it maintained what was in place. All of those bills were subjected to a two-thirds supermajority vote. How is this different than that if we're to focus on what you've pointed out about maintaining what's in place?
Thank you, Your Honor. It's true that in 2011, 2013, and 2015, LCB Legal advised the legislature that those bills required a two-thirds vote based on the case law existing at that time. In addition, LCB Legal had not been requested at that time to issue a written opinion under NRS 218F.720 that provided a legal analysis and citation of third authority in a written opinion. During the 2019 session, both the majority and minority leadership asked LCB Legal to provide a written opinion under 218F.720. We did the research. And based on that research, in particular the Oklahoma and Oregon cases, we determined that maintaining that revenue stream from one fiscal year to the next didn't fall within the meaning of creates, generates, or increases public revenue. And so we concluded in 2019, based on the most recent case law, in particular from Oregon and Oklahoma, that the bill was not subject to the two-thirds requirement. But it's true, it is a change of position of the LCB Legal Division, but it's well recognized that an agency may change its position as long as it provides a reasoned explanation for that change. We believe the 24-page opinion letter from 2019 comprehensively and exhaustively provides a reasoned explanation for LCB's change in position.
Mr. Powers, can I just follow up on that a bit? It's Justice Perry-Gary in Carson City. If we were to find this is the plain language, the language is plain and clear, and why would we give any deference to that to the legislature based upon a council opinion?
It's our opinion that these bills don't fit within the concept of creates, generates, or increases public revenue. We believe there's two reasonable interpretations that have been presented here by the defendants and by the plaintiffs. And in that situation, when there's two reasonable interpretations, the legislature is entitled to choose one of those reasonable interpretations based on the advice of counsel, and generally this court will give deference to that counseled selection by the legislature. We do not believe that the plain language creates, generates, or increases covers a bill that doesn't do any of those things, but simply maintains an existing revenue stream.
Part of your position in the opinion letter was that it directly increases or generates new taxes. Is that right?
That is correct. We believe it applies only to bills that directly create, produce, or increase new revenue in the first instance.
Wouldn't that require us to read that into the language? It doesn't exist.
Those three terms, creates, generates, increases, has dictionary definitions.
No, I'm talking about directly
and new. And if you look at the dictionary definitions.
I'm talking about directly and new.
Well, directly, if you look at the dictionary definitions, creates is produces, or and generates is produces, increases is enlarge. That has to happen. There has to be an actual change from one fiscal year to the next. Directly is just consistent with how you interpret any constitutional provision. In this case, what does the bill do directly? You don't necessarily look at indirect consequences or consequences that don't directly flow from the legislation. So we're not necessarily reading words into the constitutional provision. We're interpreting the words that are there, creates, generates, or increases.
Well, Mr. Powers, if these bills had not been implemented, the legislature would have gotten, or the state would have received less revenue, correct?
If the expiration clause had kicked in, or the reduction of rate had kicked in on July 1st or June 30th of 2019 or 2020, then yes, those things would have occurred. The legislature, however, acted before the expiration clause or the reduction was legally operative and binding. We believe in interpreting the constitutional provision, when the legislature faces a bill and determining whether it's subject to the requirement, the legislature has to look at what's legally operative at that time, not what may become operative in the future.
But Mr. Powers,
by looking at what...
Mr. Parrish, just briefly, but then wouldn't that allow the legislature to make an end run around this requirement every time there's a sunset clause? They could just take it up before it expires. You know, these are hard-fought bills. You got to get two-thirds. They happen. And then they could just be flipped any time before the sunset expires. Isn't that correct?
With regard to sunset clauses, we do not believe the two-thirds requirement applies to extending or eliminating those sunset clauses. One of the reasons for that is we believe if the two-thirds requirement applies to such sunset clauses, it creates potentially unreasonable and absurd results. What that means is one legislature could put a sunset clause on every existing revenue stream. The next legislature then could only keep revenue at its existing level by extending those by two-thirds, even though not a single cent of additional revenue would be generated. So you would allow one legislature to completely change the budgeting process for future legislatures. Because the next legislature, the minority, would say, we won't agree to two-thirds to keep existing revenues in place unless you extend the sunset just 2 years. So that every legislative session, the entire budget process is subject to the two-thirds requirement when that's not what the voters intended. They didn't intend the budgeting part to be done to two-thirds, only when there was an increase in new taxes or new revenues.
Well, that might be.
If there are no other questions by the justices on the two-thirds, I'd like to move to the cross-appeal real quickly before I turn it over to Mr. Newby.
Mr. Powers, your comment about an absurd result, it might be an absurd political result that you described, but I'm not sure that that's an absurd result under the reading of the language. If I understand the argument here, the principal source of this argument that this applies to new taxes stems from the dialogue that took place by Assemblyman Gibbons in connection with the development of the resolutions back in the mid-90s, and ultimately that was not the basis on which this went to the voters. And although we discussed that in the Gwynn case, we've since rejected that argument. So I don't know that that's very informative. I do want to go back to the plain meaning of the constitutional provision. And you or Mr. Newby both, if you would address this, I think it's important. Different from the other states that you've cited in your briefs, the language in our constitutional provision appears to be more expansive. And in that, the language itself utilizes the word any in two particulars, which under most rules of construction would compel a much broader interpretation of this provision than has been given to it in other states that have been cited. I'd like you to comment on that if you would, you or Mr. Newby or both, because as we talk about the plain language, it seems to me that it is important to understand the role that the word any public revenue in any forum plays in interpreting this provision.
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe the term any, used twice in the provision, has to still be tied to creates, generates, or increases any public revenue. If the bill does that, creates, generates, or increases, then yes, it applies broadly not just taxes, but the fees and rates and assessments. The LCB Legal Division has been advising the legislature that when a bill creates, generates, or increases, it applies across the board to all types of public revenue. But the threshold question again is, do these bills actually create, generate, or increase any public revenue? These bills, in our mind, do not do those three things: create, generate, or increase. They maintain existing levels of revenue at their same amounts and therefore do not increase existing state revenue at all. With regard to the testimony from Mr. Gibbons and this court statement in Gwynn 2 about the intent of the two-thirds requirement, if this court discounts those elements, the court should still look at the ballot question from 94 and 96. It talked about this provision would raise taxes or increase taxes, and that's when it would apply. It would apply to new sources of revenue. So the words raise, increase, those are used in the Nevada provision and the Oklahoma and Oregon provision. They're synonyms, raise or increase. I don't believe that Nevada's provision was intended to be more expansive than the provisions that were also enacted in the 90s in Oklahoma, Oregon, and the other states. The information and words provided to the voters were all the words that are used in some of those other constitutional provisions. The voters are informed this was about limiting the legislature's increasing, and I quote, new sources of revenue, raising taxes, or increasing taxes. Those were all terms used in the ballot question. So the plain language of creates, generates, or increases must be read in light of that ballot language, and none of it applies to these bills, which maintain existing levels of revenue before the bill is enacted until after the bill is enacted. We have a $1 technology fee before, $1 after. 2%, 1.4% before, 2%, 1.45% after. Really quickly then, I'd like to turn to the cross appeal. Plaintiffs are seeking, obviously, attorney fees if this court finds the two bills are unconstitutional. Plaintiffs failed in the district court to properly plead or prove attorney fees as special damages. They did not plead fraud, malice, or wantonness. They did not raise attorney fees at all in their motion for summary judgment. Only when the legislature pointed out that they had failed to properly plead and prove attorney fees for special damages did the plaintiffs below even argue attorney fees at that time. Under Sandy Valley and this court's other cases dealing with attorney fees as special damages, you have to prove and plead fraud, malice, and wantonness. They did none of those in the district court. Therefore, they waived their rights to recover attorney fees as special damages. But more importantly, the four individual defendants, Senate Majority Leader, Secretary of Senate, the Governor, and Lieutenant Governor, We're all performing core legislative functions in the legislative process. They're protected by absolute legislative immunity, which has a 400-plus year pedigree. Legislative immunity was first recognized in the English Bill of Rights of 1689 because the Crown would use civil and criminal litigation to harass and intimidate legislators and try to stop them from carrying on their official legislative duties. This is no different here. These plaintiff senators want to punish these individual defendants by requiring them to pay attorney fees in order to intimidate them from carrying out their official duties. Each of these individual defendants engaged in core legislative functions. Clearly, determining how many votes is a core legislative function. Voting on legislation is a core legislative function. Signing legislation is a core legislative function. This is the very reason we have absolute legislative immunity, is to prevent this type of intimidation, harassment by either the executive branch or the judicial branch, and in this case, other legislators, trying to punish legislators, and in this case, the governor and lieutenant governor, from doing their official duty. So from failing to plead and being blocked by absolute legislative immunity, but also by discretionary function immunity and NRS 218F720, which prohibits awards of attorney fees against the legislative defendants, these reasons block the plaintiffs from recovering attorney fees against the individual defendants if this court finds the bills unconstitutional. If the court doesn't have any questions now on those issues, I'll turn it over to Mr. Newby, and we would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Newby.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, Craig Newby, Deputy Solicitor General for the State of Nevada, appearing on behalf of the Governor, the Lieutenant Governor, and the Departments of Taxation and Motor Vehicles. To start briefly, I wish to address the question I was invited to ask when it was my turn, which is with regards to the word any within the plain language of the constitutional provision. I believe my colleague addressed the first any within the constitutional provision, which refers to any public revenue. Is the contention of the defendants in this case that there needs to be a creation, generation, or increase of public revenue, any public revenue, for that any to apply. I believe our briefing and argument has already addressed that. There is a second any that was not as directly addressed by my colleague, which is any form. In my response to that aspect of the any question would be, any form is modified by the following phrase within the supermajority provision, which is, quote, including but not limited to taxes, fees, assessments, and rates, or changes in the computational basis for taxes, fees, assessments, and rates. So any is modifying the form in terms of what form is being used to increase, create, generate, increase any public revenue. That's what that any is modifying. That it's modifying form, which is informed by that phrase behind that part of the supermajority provision. And again, it is our position, and I believe it's the most reasonable interpretation under these circumstances, that increase in particular, to the extent the plain language is not entirely clear, increase is measured against some backstop. It's measured in some way. And at best, for my colleague on the other side, the executive defendants submit that increase needs to be measured relative from one fiscal year to the next. And that what was contemplated with the purpose of this, which was to prevent new taxes in the tax backlash that occurred following the original George Bush presidency, where he violated this promise that he made to become the nominee and ultimately president, and he violated it. And
Mr. Newby,
Justice
Kadish in Carson City. So I guess I understand your argument on that it doesn't increase it because the rate stayed the same because of passing this bill. But if we focus for a second on SB 542 about the DMV fee of a dollar, right? So
yes, sir.
If that if the SB 542 had not existed, then that fee was going to expire June 30, 2020, correct?
But for bill, Senate Bill 542,
right,
the sunset would have expired the summer, right, 2020, yes.
Okay, so that $1 DMV technology fee wouldn't have existed after June 30, 2020. Because of SB 542, it did exist after June 30, 2020. So, and apparently was expected to bring in almost $7 million per year. How, given those facts, which I think are undisputed, how does the bill not generate revenue?
It doesn't bring into existence fees. These fees existed in the prior years. In fact, the DMV fee we're discussing here existed within the first of the two fiscal years that we're in the process of concluding here as a state. It already existed from one fiscal year to the next.
So if you get a two-thirds vote and say, hey, we just need this for the next 2 years, and then it'll go away, and two-thirds people say, okay, we'll suck it up for 2 years and pay this tax, then in perpetuity, you can keep it in place with just a majority. Is that right?
That is the position that the defendants are taking in this case. And certainly there could be some negative policy consequences that result from that type of interpretation in terms of legislating going forward. But that is a decision that the legislature undertook on the advice of counsel to proceed that way. And ultimately that, to the extent this very well may not be the preferred interpretation if we as litigants and this court were the legislature and coming up with what we think the most reasonable interpretation is. But under these circumstances, it is a reasonable interpretation. There is ambiguity within the term increase. And under those circumstances, the legislature is entitled to some deference. It's not entitled to it based alone on the power of the 2019 memorandum. It's entitled to it based on separation of powers and based on the requirement to try to find constitutionality within a reasonable interpretation. And finally, to also to narrowly interpret these types of provisions, which limit the legislature's overall power as the branch of government that speaks for the people and is most directly accountable to the people.
Mr. Newby,
this is their interpretation.
Mr. Newby, this is Justice Herndon, if I may. I apologize for interrupting, sir, but a quick question.
No problem.
You talk about legislative deference. What should we make of under SB 551? We all realize there's a lot of work and effort and knowledge and wisdom and experience that goes into creating these bills. What should we make of the fact that when that bill was first proposed and put forward for vote, it included a two-thirds supermajority voting requirement, which was only removed after it failed to get a two-thirds supermajority vote?
And I will briefly address that while trying to reserve at least most of the time my colleague wished to reserve for rebuttal. And in that context, it was an effort by, there's no dispute that there's a significant policy dispute between the senators that are parties to this case, whether it be Majority Leader Cannizzaro, plaintiff senators, in terms of the policy wisdom of doing this. And as set forth in my briefing, there was an effort made after this opinion was reached and received by legislative leadership to see if the policy issue could be resolved without involving the actions of this court. And this court may very well determine that rule against these defendants in terms of the legislative interpretation. But that effort on day 119 and 120 was an effort to work through compromise, to resolve policy disputes, which is the job of the legislature generally, and to do so in a way that we would not be here today. That was unsuccessful, obviously, but that was the attempt that was made by the majority leader based on the undisputed records from the Senate Finance Committee minutes and from the floor statements made by the parties. And with that, we reserve the remainder of time for rebuttal, unless there's any further questions.
Okay, Ms. Peterson, you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor. Thank you. May it please the court, Karen Peterson from Allison McKenzie Law Firm, representing the plaintiffs below, and Justin Townsend from our office is here today, and also Senator Settlemyer is here today with me. And I know the other plaintiffs are watching on the internet, and so they're here too, in theory, I guess, for the oral argument. The plaintiffs ask that you affirm the district court determination that SB 542 and SB 551 were bills that generated revenue and therefore required the two-thirds majority constitutional requirement for their passage. But for SB 542, there would not be $7 million in revenue collected by the DMV from the technology fee. And but for SB 551, there would not be an additional $98.2 million generated in revenue to the state during the biennium. The district court properly found that SB 542 and SB 551 were bills that generated or produced public revenues. And the constitutional provision that you're looking at, as you've already, I think, hopefully kind of indicated, the words used in the constitutional provision are plain, they're ordinary, they're easy to understand, and they're unambiguous. And the fact that there's another party that has a different interpretation of that constitutional provision doesn't mean that the constitutional provision is ambiguous. And that constitutional provision itself is broad, it's simple, and it's all-inclusive. The provision was put into the Constitution so that it couldn't be changed by the legislature. And our objective in the interpretation is to find the interpretation that best represents the voter's intent and doesn't hinder or violate the spirit of the constitutional provision. And so we've heard the defendants make their arguments, but they don't tell us how their interpretation best or doesn't violate the spirit of the constitutional provision or best captures the voters' objective. And they just want the court to blindly defer to the legislature's interpretation and reverse the district court. And they rely on the Nevada Mining versus the Erdos decision. But in that decision, what you did is you did not blindly defer to the legislature's interpretation, and you did your own independent analysis of the constitutional provision. And based upon that own independent analysis of the constitutional provision, you determined in that instance, the legislature's interpretation was reasonable. And throughout all the briefing and the argument, the defendants failed to recognize and acknowledge that this court did its own independent analysis under that case. And so if you look at one of the plain words used in the constitutional provision, one of the words is bill. And as we pointed out, the dictionary definition in 1994 of that word was a draft of a law presented to a legislature for enactment. And there's also a very similar definition of the word bill in the Nevada Legislative Manual, particularly in 2019 when this legislation was drafted. And again, that states that it's a draft of a proposed law presented for enactment. And the plain and ordinary word bill is broad and it's all-inclusive, and it should be given and afforded its full and fair scope to produce full coverage and not allow room for the courts to recognize ad hoc exemptions. And we raised this argument in our answering brief, and there wasn't any response to this by the defendants in their reply briefs, and they didn't dispute the definition of the word in their reply briefs. And so any kind of arguments about expiration dates and not being legally operative and binding, or even getting into whether a statute, an existing statute, is operative or effective, doesn't even come into play under this definition of the word bill. Because what's required and subject to the two-thirds majority requirement in the Constitution, what's looked at is a draft of a law presented to the legislature for enactment. And this would have been the common, ordinary understanding of the word bill by a voter in 1994 and 1996. And I know Mr. Newby raised the issue of policy considerations, and we did want to tell the court that if you adopt the defendant's interpretation and the position in this case, we do think that there are the practical effects from that are going to result in hindering the ability of the legislative members to enact legislation to get the two-thirds vote requirement, and also kind of move you into that Gwynn stalemate situation. And so even if we take the defendant's position that the constitutional provision only applies to new or increased taxes, and of course that's not our position, but even if we accept the position, that's exactly what was going on in 2015 when the commerce tax was enacted, which was a new tax, and the technology bill was implemented, or technology fee was implemented, which was a new tax. And so if the defendant's position is put into place, that sunset provisions can be overridden by a majority vote, or a future decrease in the rate can be overridden by a majority vote. Going forward, the minority is never going to agree to a sunset provision in a bill, and they're never going to agree to a future reduction in a rate in a bill. And so those types of provisions that could be put into a bill so that the legislative members could get the two-thirds vote are going to be gone. And chipping away at the definition of the word bill, or creating exceptions into the definition of the word bill, is going to hinder the ability of the legislative members to negotiate, to compromise, to come to solutions so that they can fashion a piece of legislation that they can all live with so that they can get their two-thirds vote. And Governor Gibbons in 1993, he did talk about the two-thirds majority requirement, and he said that that two-thirds majority requirement would require the members of the legislature to work together. They would have to work together in a bipartisan manner so that they can get those two-thirds vote. And that process, when there has been a consistent interpretation by the legislature of the constitutional provision, that process has worked for the last 20 years. You haven't had anybody come in here until this case with any issues with regard to any bills and violating the constitutional provisions. So we did want you to know that we think that there is going to be a big change in the process, and it is going to hinder the ability of the members of the legislature in the future to be able to come to a
Ms. Peterson, this is Justice Kadish. Would you please address cases from other jurisdictions, and in particular, I believe your colleagues across the aisle were relying on the Oklahoma and Oregon, and I guess some narrowing, perhaps, interpretations of similar provisions in those states' constitutions. How would you distinguish those from our circumstance?
Thank you, Your Honor. So we don't agree that the Oregon and the Oklahoma constitutional provisions are similar to the Nevada constitutional provision. Those constitutional provisions use the word revenue bill or raising revenue bill in their constitution. And that language is not in our constitution at all. And the other thing I wanted to bring to your attention with regard to that other case law, because Legislative Council does contend that that's the basis for the new opinion that came out in May of 2019. And their opinion is, based on the Oregon and the Oklahoma cases, that no two-thirds majority is required because the expiration date of an existing state tax was not legally operative and binding yet, or that the existing computational basis currently in effect for the existing state taxes were maintained. And again, they're saying that these words and this reasoning is from the Oregon and the Oklahoma cases. And if you look at the Oregon and the Oklahoma cases, there is no mention of the word expiration date. There's no mention or analysis of an expiration date of an existing state tax with regard to being legally operative and binding. There's no discussion about computational basis. There's no discussion about what the definition of a constitutional base is. There's no discussion about or definition of the words create, generate, or increase. And so those cases do not support the legal opinion issued by the legislative council, and they don't support the position of the defendants here. And I guess just to play the devil's advocate, if I could, with regard to this new authority from Oregon and Oklahoma, if that is new authority and that was the reason for the change in the opinion, then if there is no Nevada case law and there hasn't been any Nevada case law, and there's been no change in the contemporaneous evidence that was surrounded the enactment of the amendment, and based upon the rules of statutory construction and deleting all the other options, you know, the process of elimination, it's clear that the old opinion was based on just the plain language of the constitutional provision. So that would be my argument with regard to the other case law.
Ms. Peterson, this is Justice Hardesty. In response to my question about the use of the word any in two contexts in the language in our Constitution, as Mr. Newby pointed out, Mr. Powers addressed the first any to a large degree, but then Mr. Newby spoke to it in a slightly different term in the second use of the word any. I'd like to follow that same discussion and get your take on that question. In the context of Bill 551, the MBT tax rate, and ask you to assess whether the language in our Constitution that addresses any form as it relates to rates applies to Bill 551.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. So there was a change in the payroll tax computation rate by SB 551. That rate adjustment procedure was contained in NRS 360.203. And that was the provision that allowed the Department of Taxation to compute rate adjustments to the payroll taxes. And SB 551 repealed NRS 360.203 in its entirety. And so the repeal of NRS 360.203, you know, determined how the MBT payroll tax was computed. And because there was a change in how the payroll tax was computed, there was a change in the base. And even the fiscal analysis for LCB and Senator Cannizzaro, when they were testifying with regard to SB 551, indicated that that bill would generate revenues for the state. And the answer that the legislative defendants and the individual defendants filed in this matter too also acknowledged and admitted that SB 551 changed the rate adjustment procedure that had been used by the Department of Taxation. So if you look at the answer that was filed by the legislative defendants and the individual legislative defendants, and it's paragraphs 43, 47, and 48 of the complaint, they acknowledge that before NRS 360.203 was repealed, it contained a rate adjustment procedure used by the Department of Taxation to determine the payroll tax. They also admit that SB 551 eliminated the provisions of NRS 360.203, which again is a rate adjustment procedure, and that SB 551 eliminated the application of NRS 360.203, again, the rate adjustment procedure, to the payroll tax statutes. And those were in sections 2 and 3. Those changes to the payroll tax statutes were in sections 2 and 3 of SB 551. And they're NRS 363A.130 and NRS 363B. And I guess just in following up to that, I would point you and ask you to look at the 1997 Legislative Council opinion. that was written. And that was provided to Speaker Deeney at the time, who asked what the effect would be of this new constitutional amendment. And the language there, and I know it discussed a specific bill, and that's, of course, what the defendants pointed to in that opinion. But the opinion gave some general statements about how LCV Legislative Council viewed that constitutional provision. And one of the statements was, because of the broadness of the wording of subsection 2, it would be difficult to exclude with any confidence any bill or joint resolution which in any way, another any there, creates, generates, or increases any public revenue in any form. And the 1997 opinion also discussed computation bases, and again made this the broad general statement that the two-thirds majority vote would apply to measures which change the computation basis, which change rates, fees, assessments, taxes in any manner that would have the effect of creating, generating, or increasing state or local. And that was an opinion that was given by LCV Legislative Council close in time to the amendment. So we think that that opinion is relevant, and we think that we should take that.
Ms. Peterson, I'd like you to address another matter, if you would. It has been argued that based upon the party's respective conflicting views of the constitutional provision, an ambiguity exists. I understand that you dispute any ambiguity in this language. It's also my understanding, though, that the legislature argues that if there is an ambiguity, the court should afford deference to their opinion with respect to this interpretation and the interpretation they've given it. Do you agree or disagree with the concept that deference is limited to the general concept that governs the interpretation of the Constitution, and that is that the interpretation of the Constitution is emphatically within the province and the duty of the judicial department under Nevada's Constitution and under Marbury versus Madison?
Yes, Your Honor. I totally agree with all the statements that you made. And if I could just tell you from our plaintiff senators, their position, yes, there is a difference. Apparently, there was a difference of interpretation to the constitutional provision. But if you're going to afford the legislature deference, then you're always going to side with the majority party. They had no place else to go but to the courts to try to get an interpretation, an independent interpretation of that constitutional provision. So I totally agree that that's the function of the judiciary. And that's not the function of the legislature to determine whether their actions, they don't get to determine themselves whether their actions are constitutional.
Ms. Peterson, I don't want to foreclose any arguments you want to make, but I would like you to, in the 11 minutes, 30 seconds remaining, I'd like to get into the attorney's fee and the cross-claim issues. And specifically, I'd like you to address why it is or why you believe that the four people you wish to add to the complaint are not otherwise protected by legislative immunity in NRS 41.0711H. We haven't previously interpreted that statute before, but it appears to be pretty broad in its protected activities by its language. So I'd like to know why that statute doesn't afford legislative immunity for your claims for fees. I'm not getting into the issue of waiver or whether they're properly pled. If you want to respond to those allegations, that's fine, but I would like to focus on the question in the time remaining as to whether legislative immunity provides a basis for or a defense to the claim for fees.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, I'll do that. So So we did cite the cases, both sides did at length in our brief regard to the legislative. But as a general rule, legislative immunity does not apply to bad faith or theft. That's not legitimate legislative activity. And we don't believe...
How can there be bad faith when legislators rely on an opinion generated by their legal counsel? I understand that people have a difference of opinion about the counsel's opinion, but the fact remains that an opinion was prepared, it was provided to the folks in the Senate, and was relied upon. What's the basis for assertion, or what's the assertion of bad faith when you do that?
Your Honor, I think that we would have a much harder case that legislative immunity doesn't apply if the legislature had chosen one course of action under the Constitution, one of their interpretations under the Constitution, and then had carried that through the whole session or all the voting. But that's not what they did. They used the Constitution as a bargaining chip.
Ms.
And
Peterson,
we don't think that's appropriate.
But I'm sorry. This is Justice Silver in Las Vegas. But I had read somewhere as well that the only reason why they had put forth the two-thirds requirement initially was just to meet some of the senators halfway. So is that really a legal basis that they took two different courses of action? If they're down on the legislative floor trying to appease the other side?
Your Honor, we think with regard to the Constitution, that crosses the line of legitimate legislative activity. Because we agree, everything that's in the bill, that is all legislative activity. But when you're talking about what the Constitution for passage of that bill, that's not legislative activity. That's not economic, social, or political. That's legal. And they chose not to recognize their counsel's opinion. And so if that's the choice they made, they should have ridden that horse throughout the whole process. But they didn't. They tried to ride two horses on one constitutional provision.
Well, Ms. Peterson, I mean, if they knew that there were differing interpretations of the Constitution, and perhaps, you know, if they got the two-thirds vote, we wouldn't all be here today. So can it really be bad faith for trying to get the two-thirds and then, you know, okay, that didn't happen, so... Our view is we only need the majority and then go forward with that.
So I that creates issues again as using the Constitution as a bargaining chip. And I'll give you two examples. What if Senator Stettlemyer was in the majority party and he LCB Legal came out and said that only a majority vote was required on a piece of legislation, and he added a two-thirds majority requirement to that because he wanted to kill the legislation. That's not proper. Similarly, what if legislative counsel put a two-thirds majority vote on a bill and Senator Stettlemyer didn't think that he was going to have the vote for a two-thirds majority, and so he added just a majority vote requirement to the bill. That's playing politics with the constitutional provision, and that's where the concerns are with what happened in this case. Like I said, if they had taken one course of action and they had carried that course of action out by following their legal counsel's opinion throughout the course, then I think we would have a real hard case for obviously any kind of bad faith or that there wasn't legislative immunity. But that's not what they did.
Well, counsel, I'm sorry, but how do you break these down individually? The Secretary of the Senate, Claire Clift, How did she act in bad faith? How did Governor Steve Sisolak act in bad faith on this bill? Why just Nicole Cannizzaro? How did Kate Marshall? Like, how do we get to these the individuals here?
Well, Your Honor, we did name all four individuals, obviously, in individually on that first claim for relief for violation of the constitutional duties. And so all those individuals have statutory or constitutional duties to it as the legislation moves through the process. The secretary has to affirm that the vote was proper according to the Constitution. And she did that first for one vote that had the two-thirds majority requirement. And then she made the same kind of determination for the second vote. Same provisions of the bill, but this time they only needed a majority requirement. So how can she carry out her actions under the statute when she has two inconsistent votes and has two inconsistent determinations for the constitutionality of SB 551? And Governor Sisolak, well, and then the president of the Senate, the lieutenant governor, she also has to make determinations similar to the secretary under the statutes. And again, she declared the first bill lost, 13-8 vote, two-thirds majority requirement. 15 minutes later, the same provisions come in front of the Senate. There's just a majority requirement by the Constitution on that. And the Senate majority, the Senate president declares that vote was passed by the majority. And then as far as the governor has constitutional duties to make sure that the laws are legal and that the bills that he signs are legal. And again, if these bills required a two-thirds vote, then he didn't comply with his constitutional and statutory duties.
So any bill the governor signs, he's at risk of a judgment against him for attorney's fees if this court later decides it's unconstitutional. Is that your position?
No, that's not my position. But the problem with this scenario is that those two votes were taken with different constitutional outcomes. And the governor obviously was aware of that when he signed the bill.
Ms. Peterson, this seems to me to be a dangerous and very slippery slope where the courts of this state are put in a position of trying to assess the behavior and the conduct of legislators engaged in the legislative process about somebody stepping out of bounds, and if they did, awarding attorney's fees. I fear this would be a never-ending legal process where some legislators sue other legislators because they think they stepped out of constitutional bounds and now they're seeking attorney's fees. I don't know. How do you distinguish that kind of behavior versus here? And if you're writing an opinion in a case like this, how do we prevent an abuse where one legislator gets mad at another one and decides to sue them and claim that they're out of constitutional bounds and therefore they get attorney's fees?
Well,
but before you answer that, Ms. Peterson, if I could add one thing to what the Chief Justice was saying, doesn't this kind of tie into it's the will of the voters? If we believe our elected leaders have acted irresponsibly in how they've processed legislation, then we defer to the will of the voters to choose whether to reelect them or not. So all of that kind of ties into this very dangerous, I agree, characterization of a slippery slope that we're creating as to having the court wind its way into legislative intent and how they process their legislative activities.
And again, what I think what's different about this case is it's not just legislation going back and forth between members of the legislature. Obviously, there wouldn't even be standing for individual to sue other legislative members with regard to legislation that wasn't passed. The issue that's important here and that distinguishes this case is the Constitution and the constitutional rights of the plaintiffs, the senators, their votes, and the property owners, you know, for having to pay the unconstitutional taxes.
Ms. Peterson, and I wanted to clear up one more thing, if I could, on this attorney's fee issue. And yes, you have time to answer the question that I'm about to ask you. My understanding is that the district court you were able under its ruling to maintain a claim for fees against the Department of Taxation and the Department of Motor Vehicles. Is that not correct?
Yes, that is correct, Your Honor.
And did you ever pursue that after the judgment was entered in this case?
We haven't pursued that yet, Your Honor, because there's a stay in place, okay. And we stayed also the post-judgment attorney's fees and cost issues.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate your argument. Do any members of the court have any additional questions for Mrs. Peterson?
No, sir.
All right, thank you. Mr. Powers, you have, I'll give you another minute. So you have 3:41, sir, for your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. There was nothing constitutionally irregular about a constitutional body reconsidering a decision. Every constitutional body has the power to reconsider a decision. This court does it regularly. It will grant rehearing, withdraw an opinion, and issue a completely different opinion. The court members should not be held liable for attorney fees for reconsidering a decision and coming to a different legal conclusion. The legislature, in this case the Senate, under well-established rules of parliamentary law, reconsidered their decision and determined that a two-thirds was not required, even though the first vote they determined a two-thirds was required. Nothing constitutionally irregular. If this court were to punish these legislators for engaging in such constitutional regular behavior, you would be opening up a can of worms that has been closed for four centuries. Legislative immunity has a common law and constitutional pedigree of four centuries. The whole point of legislative immunity is to protect legislators and the governor and lieutenant governor when performing their functions and being held liable for attorney fees. Turning now to the two-thirds issue, the 1997 LCB legal opinion had broad statements about a view of a bill that creates, generates, or increases public revenue. But it didn't answer the question whether these two bills create, generate, or increase public revenue. In addition, the 1997 legal opinion from LCB didn't have any reference to case law from other jurisdictions interpreting similar supermajority requirements because that case law did not exist. If you go to the Oklahoma case of Fent versus Fallon, there the Oklahoma bill removes an expiration clause. Under the plaintiff's interpretation, it should have required a supermajority in Oklahoma. But the Oklahoma Supreme Court didn't just look at removal of the expiration clause, it looked at the actual effect of the bill, which actually decreased revenue because there were other changes in rates in the income tax. What we're asking the court to do is look at the actual effect of the bill and determine whether it creates, generates, or increases any public revenue in any form. This is an existing revenue stream. No one disputes what the definition of a bill is. There's no doubt that SB 542 and 551 were bills. But the question is not whether they were bills, but whether they were bills that create, generate, or increase public revenue in any form. They did not do that. Every fee payer is paying the same fee they paid before the bill was effective and now after the bill is effective. Every taxpayer is paying the same rate they paid before the bill was effective and now after the bill was effective. Contrary to the plaintiff's position, you have to look at the existing operative state of the law to determine the actual effect of the bill. From one fiscal year to the next fiscal year. In this case, there was no change in that existing stream of revenue. Therefore, the bills did not create, generate, or increase any public revenue in any form. And this does not violate the intent or the spirit of the constitutional provision. Again, the ballot material specifically told the voters that this constitutional provision would prevent increases in taxes, raising taxes, and would prevent the legislature from seeking new sources of revenue unless they met the supermajority requirement. These bills did none of that. They were not subject to the supermajority requirement. Thank you, Governor.
All right, thank you, Mr. Powers. At the beginning of the argument, I noted conference with council, and I want to express thank you and my how proud I am of the lawyers for working as hard as you did to move the case forward. You did a lot of work in a short amount of time, and I appreciate your input and your briefing and your arguments today. I know the other members of the court feel exactly the same way. Thank you for your work on this matter. The case will stand submitted, and we will be in recess.